once more unto the breach, dear friend.
Else close the wall up with our English dead.
And here we are, ladies and gentlemen, boys and girls, with another exciting second hour of The Personal Wealth Coach on this Saturday, March 1st, 2014, starring Jeff and
Jake
McClure. See, I got the date. You know, so I slipped the date in there
was
very
pretty good.
Subtly so that...
It wasn't so subtle. It was right there in the...
It was subtle.
Subtle, yes.
Subtle. Then
subtle has a subtle B.
Well, you know, one of the big points that we want to make today about the news is what isn't in the news.
Yes.
No airplanes crashed on Friday.
Correct.
At least none that were reported.
No major earthquakes took place in any capital city of the United States.
Right.
As well as...
There were minor earthquakes taking place in East Texas.
Right, but no major ones in the capital
right,
of the United States.
Right,
right.
And one other thing of great significance that didn't get reported that wasn't in the news is the S&P 500 on Friday broke another all-time record. And that amazing... This is the amazing thing. It's not that the S&P 500 hit an all-time high on Friday at the close. It's that... I shouldn't say nobody noticed, because I did. But I didn't notice until today. The S&P 500 stock index is now back up to above where it was at the beginning of the year. The Dow Jones Industrial Average is about 1.5% below its all-time record. So we're just kind of percolating along in a secular bull market. And I say that, let's put it like this. When a bull market has gone on for 5 years, well, actually not quite 5 years, it'll be another month or two until it's 5 years, we can probably say this is a secular bull market. And when, after 5 years, the price-to-earnings ratio, by whatever measure you want to give it, is still at or below its long-term norms after 5 years of run-up, man, I think we're in a secular bull market here, because, interestingly enough, earnings in American corporations are rising fast enough that if the market simply stays at its current price-to-earnings ratio, it's going to rise another 9% this year. Now, does that mean it will rise 9%? No. It could rise a lot more, and we could have a correction sometime along the way. As a matter of fact, could. I will tell you that the probability of there being a 10 or 15% drop in the market sometime this year is pretty high. I can also tell you that the probability is that when it hits bottom, and nobody can forecast what the bottom is on these things, the rise that follows that 10 to 15% drop will be about twice as much as it went down, or about 30%. So this is something I'll just flat tell you, and I can say that Warren Buffett happens to agree with me completely, which means he's pretty smart.
That's the only reason why he's smart.
Well, obviously he's smart because, well, actually he does meet the criteria, because if you're so smart, why ain't you rich?
Right, he is rich.
Yeah, and I think by almost anybody's definition, Warren Buffett qualifies as rich. Particularly, what did he call his private jet? Unjustified. But this is the point I want to make is that we're almost certainly going to have a correction this year. I say almost certainly. Very high probability of a correction at some point this year for no particular reason whatsoever, just because it's been so long since we've had one, and people really, really need a reason to be afraid or they're unhappy. Secondly, we are almost certainly in a long-term secular bull market. Long-term secular bull markets typically run about 15 years, sometimes a little longer, which means that if we go back and we say, okay, it's almost 5 years old, then we probably have another decade of really good returns. But here's a very, very important point if you're an investor in the markets in any way. somewhere along the way, we're also going to almost certainly have a 1987. And mainly, I can say that with some degree of confidence because the majority of investors that I speak to who are actually invested in equities or in mutual funds or whatever, when I say another 1987, they give me this blank stare like, what?
What?
Once we have forgotten something like 1987, that's when they return. And since we're not afraid of that, because we've forgotten about it, okay, it's going to happen. The thing about 1987 is, of course, for those of you who don't know what I'm talking about, which is probably the majority of the listeners, in August of 1987, the Dow Jones in the S&P 500 hit record highs, and everybody was happy. We'd had a recession in 1982. So it's about 5 years into a bull market, which is, that's where we are now. And the market dropped 30% in one day. And that kind of, I don't think it was 30, it was 19% in one day, and then it kept dropping. And it was at a point of maximum optimism. And, you know, I could see that coming this summer. I could even see the same time frame where in October the market drops 30%. And, of course, the first reaction I typically get of people is, oh, should we get out of the market? No. Warren Buffett had some guidelines. I don't know if you're aware of this. His letter was published today, I think. But he had some comments leading up to, he was on the radio in, I think, Chicago, and it was leading up to the publication of his annual investor's letter. And he had several things that are very, very important. One of the things he said is, if you're an investor without somebody giving you sophisticated advice, an S&P 500 index fund is not a bad place to be. I can't argue with that. Now, I think that we are the people who give the sophisticated advice, so we don't use S&P 500 index funds. But, you know, you could do worse. And he also said that if he were to die today, he's instructed his executor to take the money that he will leave to his wife and put it 90% in equities and 10% in T-bills. I want you to think about that just a second. Of course, he's leaving a lot of money to her, so she could probably live a long time on that 10%. And I know from previously reading things that he has to say, what he means is have enough money sitting there to weather a correction or even a bear market of the kind that we typically have in this era, in cash or in something very, very short and secure, and invest the rest of it and ignore the volatility. And that's the other thing he said. Ignore the short-term moves of the market. Ignore the ups and downs. Ignore the price fluctuations of companies and the market itself. Be highly diversified and invest in things that have long-term capacity and probability of creating more value. Hear that last one?
Mm-hmm.
Invest in things that have a long-term capacity, capability, and probability of creating more value in our system. Gold doesn't do that.
The idea of being able to make a profit, to make money in something, rests on the concept of being able to create something of value that people want to pay for.
Unless your name is Madoff.
Right. So the idea...
Or Gox.
you can buy a sports trading card and sell it later for more money.
Or less.
Or less money. And the reality is that what people are paying for is scarcity there and the idea that somebody might actually want it. So there's a demand involved and there's a supply involved. Gold is exactly that. It's a commodity. There's a demand and there's a supply.
And so are bitcoins.
Bitcoins, again, same thing. Demand and supply. If the supply is limited, which with bitcoins it's limited, mm-hmm. and the demand is high, the price goes up. When people recognize that the underlying thing is not very valuable, the demand drops. You can't use it for things. This has happened to gold. It certainly happened to bitcoins. It will happen further to bitcoins. I have absolutely no doubt in my mind. And I don't generally say that sort of thing I don't generally come out and say I've got no doubt in my mind about very many things. This is one of those things that I've got little doubt. In 10 years, bitcoins will be a blip on the radar. In 5 years, they're going to be probably worthless. And in 3 years, people are going to recognize that if they haven't recognized it already.
Mm-hmm. But I think it's interesting that the drop in bitcoin, the drop in gold occurred
simultaneously.
Well, in the same
gold
range.
Gold was a little bit more. It happened before that. I had somebody say that you predicted that gold prices were going to fall, and they haven't.
I had somebody say that too, and I said, "Well, yeah, only about 30%.
It's more than that, actually. They were up close to $2,000. It was the upward range of $1,900 an ounce, and it's dropped significantly from there.
It's about $1,300.
It's about $1,300 now, and that's after having a little upswing. It was down to $1,100. So the reality is that it's supply and demand." And unless the demand increases and the supply decreases, the price is going to do what it does. It's that simple. You're not creating anything with that. Now, on the other hand, in the past, we have had investments in the sectors that do natural resource mining, gold mining companies, because they're trying to get gold out of the ground. People are willing to pay for the value of taking a rock and turning it into gold. People wish to pay for that. That is creating a value, and as long as they do it in a way that it doesn't cost more to get it out of the rock than it does to sell the gold, they make a profit.
And I want to emphasize here something that Warren Buffett said, and that is broad diversification is important. The fact that we, for example, sometimes use mutual funds that are natural resources mutual funds that also happen to own some gold mining shares, they also own copper mining shares and all kinds of other things like that. The issue is that commodities are useful in our society. They are needed. And by the way, the commodities prices have generally run up this year, which is a very, very good sign for the economy. When commodities prices across the board are rising, it's important to look and see why, by the way. Make sure it's not speculators. But what we're seeing is commodity prices are rising because economies are recovering and they need more stuff. And let me tell you how to match that up. If you look at the report that came out of the reports that come out of the Commerce Department, that it reports on the economy in general, one of the things that came out very clearly on when we talked about the revision in GDP that just came out is that one of the biggest contributors to the rise in GDP in the fourth quarter, now that they've got all the data together in the Bureau of Economic Analysis, is long-term investing, capital investing in equipment by companies in the United States rose about 10% on an annualized basis in the fourth quarter. Now, consumer buying up about 1.6% on an annualized basis. You go through all these other things that people are moaning and complaining about. The key looking down into there for us, if you're a long-term investor, this is where you should look when you see one of these reports. When companies are buying, making capital long-term investments in equipment, it's because they anticipate being able to use that equipment to make money. The second thing that's crucial to understand is that it is not the Indians or the Chinese who are replacing workers in the United States. It's machines. Sometimes it's computers. Sometimes it's physical machines run by computers. And so companies buying capital equipment, particularly if it's in the higher technology areas and they're not just replacing worn-out bulldozers, when the companies are doing that, there's a couple of things you can expect down the road. One, fewer jobs. fewer jobs per measure of the GDP. As the GDP goes up, the jobs don't rise as fast. Why? Because we're making more gross domestic product with fewer people. which, by the way, we have been doing for a couple of hundred years now.
More than that.
It's not, I mean, in the United States.
And yeah, and it's been happening over time from the beginning.
Right.
I mean, the wheel made it possible to use a couple of horses to replace a lot of people.
Yeah, and we probably should have banned that right
yes,
from the beginning. Right?
We are exporting jobs to horses.
But the issue is, as investors, to look around and be aware of what's really happening beneath the surface. There's a big lot of noise about unemployment. Yes, it's a serious problem because if people aren't spending money, we're not making as much money. And we have a slow recovery. The slow recovery, though, if we take a look beneath the hood, if you will, of the slow recovery, we find a lot of capital-intensive equipment being made. We find that our exports in the United States are a bigger percentage of our GDP than they have been any time in my memory. We're making more stuff. We're selling more stuff. We are creating, the price of energy is dropping as we create more oil in the United States. You look at all these things and you say, long term, those are all excellent. That means the United States economy is healthy. It's doing a lot of things that will bring money into the economy. I think I mentioned last hour, earnings up about 9.3%, as I recall, now that we've got all the fourth quarter stuff in on an annualized basis. The fact that the economy grew at 2.4, they revised it back to, from 3.2 or something like that. That's insignificant. What's significant is that American corporations, where we invest our money when we buy mutual funds in American corporations, for example.
Or stocks. We don't do it, but stocks.
Are buying new stuff to make themselves more productive, to make more things, to raise the standards of what they're doing.
Right.
That's healthy, and that's if one,
not just buying more stuff, but spending more time training their employees on how to use the more stuff, on how to get better at using new technologies.
And there's a huge movement in society going on. I'm kind of dominating this thing and not getting there's a huge movement going on in society, which you may also read about if you read about what's going on. The upper income people have their income rising fast, relatively speaking. The lower-income people, roughly the lower half of our society, their actual buying power has been declining since 1970 and is continuing to decline.
I have a good reason for that, and this is actually something I did want to talk about. You kind of segued very nicely into it. We've been talking a lot to our clients. We get the ability to see very successful people on a regular basis. And something that I have noticed in that regular basis is that children of our successful clients tend to be successful people.
Whoa.
It's a little bit strange because...
Does Warren Buffett have any children?
Yes.
Oh.
But going to the concept there, it is not unusual for our high net worth clients to speak on a regular basis to their children about money.
They talk to their children?
Yeah, it's amazing. And I want you to think about, we'll go out on a limb and talk about this. Most of us consider this group the scum of the earth, a trust fund baby. You know, somebody that's grown up, doesn't know the value of money, so on and so forth.
As long as they spend it.
They spend it and tend to actually end their lives with more money than they started with because every dinner table conversation has to do with money. Now, I'm not saying that you should take on values and principles of this group of people. I am saying that the concept of communicating within your own family about the mistakes and the successes that you have had with money is going to go a long way to allowing your children not to make the same mistakes. We don't have a class system in the United States, but if you're coming up from a lower class, if you're coming up from a poor family, you have a much steeper hill to climb because, first off, you're
I
not...
I think that is unfair.
What, that they're climbing a steep hill?
Yes.
It may be unfair. There's no statement of fairness in any area of economics that I've ever checked.
I had to make that, you know.
You've got a steeper hill because your family hasn't spoken to you about investments, about cash, about money. You may have even been encouraged to take out lots of debt. It's a good idea. I mean, you're going to college, take out lots of student loans, or take a lot of, you just start your credit history, get lots of credit cards. This is not good advice. So recognizing that each of us in our lives have made mistakes, if we don't talk to our family about those mistakes and about our successes without getting our status involved, this is a question I ask a lot of my clients. Why is it rude at a barbecue in your neighborhood to ask a friend that you've known for 20 years, how much money do you make in a year?
I ask all the time.
You do, but this is, you see, that's a rude question.
I'm a rude person.
The reason why it's rude is because American society is built around this concept of keeping up with the Joneses. Well, whoever the Joneses may be, if they are the standard and they've been doing it for multiple generations, it's because they're telling their kids about it. So if you look at your family and you treat them the same way you do as your friend at the barbecue, you're doing an injustice to your children. They need to learn from your mistakes so they don't make the same mistakes. If your parents had told you about the mistakes they had made and about the successes that they had made, you may have had a larger foundation on which to build.
Now, this is my question. Did your parents tell you?
Yes. Not only did they had me in charge of their finances for a long time.
As a child?
Yes, as a child, if you consider it in the legal sense. It was before I was 18.
Wow, that's scary. So you're trying to say that that your parents basically allowed a child to manage their financial affairs.
See, you're keeping up with the Joneses here. Your ego is boosting. My parents, one of them happens to be the one asking me if my parents had...
Yeah, but having a child managing their finances, that's scary.
Well, with supervision. The concepts here that we're talking about, if you go to any...
Is that like X-ray vision?
Yes, the concepts, x-ray.
No, supervision, is that like...
Supervision is x-ray vision. Oh, yes. No,
that means you can see really, really well?
Right. Supervision.
You went and got an operation for that.
Yeah, laser vision.
Yes, anyway.
Yes, I have laser vision.
But the important thing, and he's saying this, and I want to emphasize that it's true. If we can communicate across society, we can open up and tell each other our successes and failures and open up and talk about them, particularly in finance, we can go a long ways in the right direction. And unfortunately, our school system does a pretty terrible job preparing people to manage their 401k or 403b or their PQRST.
I think they do a negative preparation. They actually remove any preparation that may have been there before. This is kind of both of our rant. We get up on this soapbox, and the good thing about soapboxes is when you get down off of the soapbox, at least your feet are clean.
Theoretically,
if it's a full soapbox, that is. And what we're saying here is if you contemplate in your lives, most of the people listening to this program, according to the ratings, are between the ages of 35 and 65. How often did your parents talk to you about their successes or failures? And do you think you could have benefited from knowing about their successes and failures? If you turn around and do exactly the same thing and not communicate or communicate, how do you think that's going to result with your kids? I'm not saying you should go to a barbecue and start telling everybody all your successes and failures. I don't think that that's a great idea at all. You're going to get laughed out of the barbecue. But if you can't take this in a serious nature and educate your kids, because nobody else is going to do it. The government will at least educate them on the birds and the bees. I'm not sure how much we want that, but they will. They'll do it.
The birds and the bees, the biology?
Oh, yes. There's pollen.
Okay, got it.
That sort of thing happens. There's stuff that floats around. And birds mate with bees, and you get these.
Well, to get off the subject just a little bit, I want to, since we're being irreverent and maybe irrelevant today.
When are we not?
We mentioned last hour the S&P 500, or at the beginning of this hour, the S&P 500 hit a new closing high on Friday. Reading the newspaper articles about it are, I think, enlightening. This is the point. Barron's, which is a very well-respected, they do a really good job of reporting. The fellow who writes The Trader, and we have a different person writing. It's Avi Salzman who wrote it this week. Went around and asked people who are major movers and shakers or traders on New York Stock Exchange why everybody is so bullish. And they said, okay, here's the answer that Avi, which may be a male or a female, got, said, strong consumer confidence data, evidence of sales growth. Sales growth for durable goods, major manufactured products like electronic and defense. In other words, those are all positive things about the economy that caused the market to rise last week. Now, same paragraph. Federal Reserve Chair Janet Yellen also helped lift markets in testimony before Congress when she remarked that economic data has been surprisingly weak.
Weak. So this lifted markets, that data's
now,
weak.
Wait a minute. In the same paragraph, we have evidence of a strong economy which lifted the market, and Janet Yellen also lifted the market because she said we have weak economic data.
That may be a little confusing to some people.
That's a little confusing to anybody. And you know, and the point is, the market didn't rise because of strong reports.
Or weak reports, for that matter.
Or Janet Yellen's comments that the economic data is weak. The market rose because it rose.
We talk about this with clients as well. A piano at auction. If there is one person in the room mildly interested in buying that piano, the price is not going to go up. There's only one person bidding. Same auction with 10 people interested in the same piano, that piano price goes up. If the piano price starts at a high price and there's only one or two people interested, that price might drop because they're only willing to pay a lower amount. That's what the market does. It's the number of people willing to buy, interested in buying, and the number of people interested in selling. Whether or not they're interested in buying or selling based on Janet Yellen or a report or anything else, a lot of times it only has to do with, and this is interesting, you can look at when paychecks go in, 401ks, there are certain days during the month that tend to be up no matter what the news is because the paycheck hit the 401k.
Right.
And there's certain times during the year that happen to be down no matter what the news is because people are doing tax sales. So there's a lot of things that we know about the market that the media doesn't really look at.
And this is interesting. As soon as one of these items becomes well known,
it stops working.
It will disappear and sometimes even reverse itself because people will step in to take advantage of it. We used to do rebalancing on the first day of the quarter or the first business day of the quarter as soon as we could, because that's when the major pension funds a few days later
would rebalance.
And if we rebalanced in front of them, we determined that we would have a little kick upward that we otherwise wouldn't get, and we were really happy with that. Well, guess what? It disappeared because we're not the only people who noticed that.
Not only that, you published it. As soon as you publish it, people go, oh, well, that's a pretty easy thing. I'll just start doing that.
I don't think a lot of movers and shakers read my newsletter, but on Wall
published.
Street.
It's published. Well, I mean, you never know. I mean,
right. But the other thing that is reported in Barron's, if you read down a couple of paragraphs, a guy named Paul LaFleche, who only manages about $13 billion.
Oh, that's all?
For FM Global. He says, maybe it's the absence of negatives. He says, I don't think there was a particularly strong positive catalyst at all. He says, maybe it's just the absence of negatives. People continue to have a lot of cash and want to come back to stocks.
Absence is a negative. So it's the negative negatives.
Right.
Right.
It's the absence of negatives. And he said, it really boils down to something very simple. There wasn't any bad news. People have cash sitting around, and they watch the market go up, and they think maybe we ought to invest a little more in the market.
Well, we have some commercials to play. We also have some numbers to give out if you'd like to talk to us.
One.
That is a number.
Three.
There is another number.
Okay.
Those are numbers that we have now given out. And today, the number three is brought to you by
773-1400 in East Bell. If you want to give us a call and make a comment, and we've not exactly been buried with comments today, 773-1400 if you're in East Bell County.
Otherwise, it's 1-866-597-1400, and that is toll-free, 866-597-1400.
And while I don't want to make any promissory statements, I think there's a fairly high probability that we will return after these important words from KTM sponsors. And we're back with more of the Personal Wealth Coach, starring Jeff and
Jake
McClure. Telephone number's in here, 773-1400 or
1-866-597-1400.
And we have a caller on 773-1400, and you are on the air with the Personal Wealth Coach. Go ahead.
All right, thank you. I have a couple of things that I want to lay out, and now I want to ask a couple of questions. With the Obamacare health plan, a lot of people are paying a lot more premiums than normal. Myself included. My company is self-insured, but our premiums went up and our deductibles went up a great deal also. And, mm-hmm. of course, all the people who are going to have to spend money that they haven't normally on health care premiums because they're required to enroll. What kind of effect do you think that will have on people's their spending money, walking around money, the things they normally buy cell phones or TVs or just regular consumerism with that they won't have in the future? Also, when people do have to get health care, they're going to have to meet the deductible on their own first because the insurance company is not going to kick in until, $2,500 or $1,500 worth. So people are going to find out that they're going to have to save. So that it'll be more and more less money that people will be using for consuming. How big of an effect do you think that would have on our economy?
Okay.
All right. Both of those questions kind of come from the same perspective. So I'm going to cover the second one first, and then we'll go to the first one. The second one about the deductible is that even people that generally have had insurance in the past, this is a sad truth, haven't saved enough for their deductibles. They get billed and they have to pay in installments and so on. They don't owe that at the time of service most often. They get billed by the hospitals.
Well, the insurance company is going to cover the doctor's cost for the service.
Right.
If the service costs $2,000, insurance is going to pick it up after $150.
The insurance pays everything above a certain deductible, and after that you owe. But when it's all over, you still owe the deductible back to the hospital,
right,
or the doctor.
I'm not saying that what you were saying is wrong. It's just that most people don't save that money beforehand.
Mm-hmm.
Some people do, and that's going to have it. The society as a whole after the Great Recession has been saving more. But to go to your first question, people are spending more money on premiums. More people are spending money on premiums than were before. There's
right.
more health insurance coverage. There's a grand experiment going on here, an experiment that we get to learn from. Because nobody's ever done it like this before. What we know, and this is something I could have told you before it happened, we did say before it happened, people had health problems before Obamacare.
No.
It's amazing, I know.
You're gonna get in trouble.
It was being paid for before, because doctors were not going bankrupt on a regular basis. It was being paid for by people that had insurance. And people
right.
that didn't have insurance weren't paying for it. So in the next few years, we're going to have some fluctuations in prices of premiums in all kinds of different directions. The cost of healthcare is going to change. And we don't know what it would have been without Obamacare. That's one of the things that is important to recognize. We're looking at this through a one-lens environment. We don't know what would have happened without it. What we do know is that this is a new system. It's going to have an impact. But if we look back and we say we had health problems before, people are probably not going to have a problem this year that they wouldn't have had if Obamacare was not here. So the same environment health-wise exists. It's just changing how we pay for it. Who's paying for it? If more people are paying for it than were before. Before it was the people that were covered. Now it's everybody, hopefully. eventually that should lower the price, but it may also lower the quality of care. There's a lot of questions there.
There's a fundamental thing that's going on here. And if you drill down to it and look at it as rationally as you can, it generally is the reverse of what most people seem to think it is. In other words, healthcare, the healthcare gap, which was huge, was being largely covered by the government prior to Obamacare, and the cost of healthcare was rising astronomically for the government.
9 to 11% a year.
And we're looking down the roads and seeing that we could become a Greece, we could become a
Ukraine.
Ukraine or something, purely on the cost of health care at the governmental level. Unless,
General Motors. Or,
unless we did what Germany has done and slap a big surtax on everybody's income to pay for health care. Well, we chose not to go that way. So what's happened? The reason you're paying more, the reason a lot of people are paying more, is because we are shifting the responsibility for paying for the health care we want from the government to the people who are getting it. So those who want the deficit to go down, they want more fiscal responsibility in Washington. The biggest expense on the budget,
Medicare.
The biggest threat to expense on the budget,
well,
is yeah. Medicare. And the reason
secondary
you say,
is,
well, I'm not on Medicare, so obviously I'm not involved with it. Well, the fact is that the hospitals have to stay in business. The Medicare costs go up. And you're going to think this is really weird. One of the major drivers in this 9 to 11% increase in Medicare cost every year was the young people coming into the hospital who busted their head, and I'm going to use this as an example, who busted their head riding a motorcycle and didn't have any health insurance. The hospital then raises their, across the board, they have this happening.
They would raise the rates for the people that were paying, including Medicare.
And Medicare is the biggest people who pay, and Medicare sets the prices based on general prices. So we had a situation we were headed for bankruptcy as a nation on the basis of health care. We have shifted that around to say, you folks out there need to cut, everybody needs to get covered so that you aren't a free rider. And, you know, insurance theory says this should work very well.
If everybody gets right, covered, then prices are going to come down.
And in Massachusetts, the place where Governor Romney implemented this same program, the actual overall cost of premium of the medical system and all stabilized, leveled off, and then began to drop
before it increased. And the increase came because a lot of people were leaving the state they were in to go back over there.
Until people started flocking to Massachusetts to get the health care coverage.
Right. So to come back to the question, it may have sounded like we just answered something to sound like we really think that Obamacare is the greatest thing or that this is the great. There were probably 80 different proposals that I think would have been better than the one that actually made it into law. Starting with Nixon, going through Reagan, even Hillary's concepts way back when her husband was president, had some better parts to it than Obamacare. However, we needed to do something. Something was done, and I think we should focus on fixing the broken parts. But looking at the impact to the economy long term, it is status quo. I realize that's really weird. On the big, big picture, it was either taxpayers and insurance paying individuals that were paying it, or it's the whole economy that's paying it. Well, taxpayers and insurance, so it was getting paid before. It's going to get paid now. It's just getting paid differently.
And this is the thing, if you look at the metrics, you can't, we look at our premiums right now and they are what they are, and believe me, we pay them so we understand. I paid $52,000 in premiums last year for my company.
Yes.
You know, so I can tell you that I understand what you're talking about. But here's the point. Long term, there is a very high probability that this system, well, we've already seen it. Last year, the cost per patient dropped. Did you get that? For the first time in 30 years.
That's not insurance costs. That is actual health costs, care costs.
When we're paying insurance premiums and the outflow starts down, the things that the insurance companies have to pay starts down, premium, then the insurance companies get into the competition business and they start lowering their premiums to attract you to them. And that's where we're going, I think.
Is that cost per person, like the aggregate health care cost of the country divided by the number of people in it?
It's per patient.
Per patient. Okay.
Which is the only way you can really measure the output of this thing.
This is something that I would encourage our listeners. Most of our listeners fall into a very conservative bent. I'm going to encourage our listeners to listen for just a minute more thoroughly than usual. If we don't make the law that is on the books right now work better, it is likely to be replaced by a single-pay system.
Yeah, that's the next. If this doesn't work, everybody else in the world has put a single system in, single-pay system, which is the government. Everybody gets Medicare, in effect.
Basically, we need to fix the system that is still using private citizens' money and private insurance companies' payment methodologies.
In a marketplace.
In a free and open marketplace. It's a broken marketplace. There's a lot of problems with it. But if we don't fix that, the alternative is not going to be repeal of this because there are too many people that are getting used to it already.
Yeah, there's 26 million people.
I just want to say, I value you two guys an awful lot. And if I was stranded on a desert island and I could only have one radio show.
Hopefully it would be a survival program.
You've replaced it for me.
Thank you.
I look at Fox News and I listen to talk radio through a whole different filter now.
We appreciate that.
I wish the voice of truth instead of agenda.
Well,
reign supreme, and I'll tell you what, I love you guys a bunch.
Thank you very much.
So much and, better.
All right.
I don't know if I'm going to be able to get out the door. My head just grew about four sizes.
I can even tell you, if you see that in us, and we work at it, by the way, there's a reason, and the reason is nobody is paying us to do this show. We are compensated by our clients directly. They pay us fees. We get on the show because we got a lot of clients that listen to it. We've debated, why are we taking our Saturday mornings?
We're not making any money doing this.
Because we don't. We don't get a host of clients come flooding in the door because we do this radio program.
No.
So why do we do this? And the answer is, I'm writing a very serious paper right now that's going to run to 80 pages on professionalism. And I can tell you that one of the things that sets professionals apart from other occupations, one of the key things that's all through the history of professions, is the desire to serve the general public. Now, if you go to a commercial radio station, and I'm not knocking any commercial radio station, this is one, look at who is paying the people who you're listening to and how they make their money. They will be driven by that just like we are. Does that make sense to you?
Yeah. Yes, I do. I've heard you say that before, and those are the things that I look for now. So,
Rush Limbaugh said that, follow the money.
Yeah, I like to go back to part of the reason why we're on here. There is a selfish reason.
There is?
Oh, yeah. It may be a...
So we can talk to each other for 2 hours?
There is that, too. I consider this program the same way I consider paying my property taxes. I'm paying for the education with my time of people. I think that if more people understand how the economy works, it's going to work better. I think if more people understand how to long-term treat their own finances better, I'm going to do better because of it. All of us are. The whole concept of capitalism is based on Adam Smith's idea, and that invisible hand is a reality. Mm-hmm. If we make sure everybody around us does better, so are we.
And appreciate your call, by the way. And yet, did you have another question?
No, that'll do me. Thank you very much.
Thanks for the call.
You're welcome.
And again, I know that a lot of people, having heard what we just said, because we didn't castigate Obamacare, would think, "Oh, you're pro." No, I'm not. We're not.
There are a lot of better alternatives. This is the one that we have.
But this is what we've got, and I can tell you that there is a reality there. Number one, I noticed that on the ballot is the opportunity to tell the Republican Party to repeal Obamacare. Folks, folks.
That's how Republicans will lose votes.
We are talking about tens of millions of people if we repealed Obamacare today.
College students would lose their coverage all over the country.
In March is when the new coverage hits for the uninsured people. That's this month.
Yeah.
And the people who signed up, and there are tens of millions of them who have now signed up, because they didn't all come through the government website. They went through a lot of other places. All of those people are going to be insured.
You repeal this, they're not insured anymore.
If we were to repeal Obamacare very conservatively, 30 million people would have their insurance terminated because of the repeal of Obamacare. Now, can you imagine? Let's just give you an example. And I've had Republican stamped on my voter ID card for longer than most of our listeners have probably been alive. Can you imagine the Republican Party getting the credit for canceling the health insurance on 26 or 30 million people suddenly?
As much as it knocked Obama to have 5 million people canceled in the process of getting them recovered, think, multiply that times 6 or 7 times.
And I want to tell you that most of those people are people who don't normally vote.
They would vote for this.
Most of those people are low income because they figured out that they can get the insurance for free. And they can if they have low enough income. They've applied. They finally got health insurance for their family. They can finally go see a doctor without being afraid. They can finally call an ambulance, which, by the way, is a big deal. I just attended a thing last week down in Williamson County where one of the MS priorities is to go into what they call the underserved areas. People in lower income areas don't call the ambulance, and as a result, they die. When they get this Obamacare insurance and they realize they can finally call 911 if somebody has a heart attack without being afraid, when that occurs, can you imagine the Republican Party getting the credit for yanking? Those people would vote in the next presidential election.
So we have to make
And they don't
this,
normally vote now.
We need to make this law better than it is already, a lot better than it is already. We got to fix all the flaws, and we got to make sure that it stays privatized. Otherwise, the alternative is all those people are going to go out and vote for a single-pay system. And that is really a bad idea for the country.
We'll get everybody covered by Medicare. That's what the Democrats want, and that's what they'll get if we abolish this one. And we're out of time on this March 1st. Of 2014.
Yes. So if you'd like to contact us off the air, we have voicemail waiting locally at
947-1111.
You can also reach us toll-free at 1-800-914-7526, 1-800-914-PLAN. We get a lot of our inspiration on what we talk about from conversations with people that send us emails or talk to us on voicemail. So you may also reach us at email at jeff@tpwc.com or jake@tpwc.com. You can go to our webpage, though your sanity is in peril, and listen to podcasts there at thepersonalwealthcoach.com or tpwc.com.
So until next week, this has been the Personal Wealth Coach.
Your Fox News station in Central Texas, News Radio 1400 KTEM AM, Temple, Belton, Killeen, Fort Hood.